The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And if you want to see some spectacular photos, you need to follow @fishscientist on Twitter or Instagram. That's fish_scientist. Because she's sitting right here in the studio with us right now. She's a new faculty member in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, Danielle Dixon. Danielle, thanks for joining us on Campus Voices.
Thanks for having me.
So how did a nice girl from Minnesota end up in Delaware via Florida, New Guinea, Australia, and Hawaii?
I guess when I was really little, I went to the Shedd Aquarium and asked a question about a whale. And the person that was working there gave me a book, and I got really excited that I got something that was actually worth money when I saw it at the gift shop. And I asked my mom, you know, what does that guy do? What's his job? And she told me he was a marine biologist, which now knowing that he probably actually wasn't. But I'm glad she told me that, because since then I just wanted to be a marine biologist and never really changed my mind.
Well, that answers my next question, which was, what attracted you first, the diving or the fish?
Definitely the fish. So,
but you started diving, you said, in high school up in Minnesota?
Yeah, so I did my first job my first dive in Square Lake in Stillwater, Minnesota. It was in August, but it's still really cold once you go under the thermocline, and there's not really that much to see. I think they sunk like weird stuff underwater. There was like a toilet and some other strange things.
Just so you could find something.
I think so that we could see things, but it was so cold. It was in August, but it was still so cold once you got below the thermocline. And I was just thinking, oh, man, I can't wait till I can get into the actual ocean.
So you did end up going to college in places at the ocean.
Yeah, I did my first year at Hawaii Pacific on Oahu. And then I transferred to University of Tampa, did my final 3 years there for my undergrad. And then I did my PhD in Australia, James Cook University.
And when you were at James Cook, I think, is when you ended up in New Guinea.
Yep. So most of my PhD research was done right on the Great Barrier Reef at Lizard Island Research Station, which is the northernmost inhabited island. There's like a giant resort. Actually, it's a really small resort, but for really, really rich people. And then there's a research station on the island. So
let me guess, you were at the research station.
Yeah. We aren't even allowed at the resort, but the resort guests tend to almost run us over with their boats that they give them pretty regularly. So you do have some interaction with the resort guests from there, but not much. I think Terry Hatcher stayed there, and the Crocodile Dundee guy stayed there, and Oprah came. So it's pretty fancy.
That actually is interesting you're telling us about that, because that hits right to some of the issues that marine scientists are facing now, where you've got the resort and the boats and the research station right there on the northernmost island of the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where a lot of the resort guests will come and they'll get tours from the research station. So we can show them around and show them what we're doing. And then we're not really allowed at the resort, but that's fine. I was quite happy at the research station anyway. So
what kinds of things were you looking at when you were at the research station up there on the Great Barrier Reef?
Most of the research that I did at Lizard Island was on ocean acidification. So looking at how future climate conditions are going to affect the behavior of coral reef fishes.
To me, it was a surprise that some of the things you're looking at with ocean chemistry and acidity also leads to you looking into what fish can smell.
So the funny thing about it is I think most people don't realize that fish actually have a really good sense of smell. And it's just probably because we don't have a good sense of smell underwater, but a lot of the stuff in the water just releases chemicals, which are essentially smells. And fish just are really good at detecting those different chemicals. But one of the things that we found was under future climate change conditions, so ocean acidification levels that are expected within the next 100 years, they lose their ability to tell the difference between smells. So a normal fish can tell the smell of a predator versus a non-predator, which is a really important thing so that they stay away from something that will eat them. But a fish raised under climate change scenarios of around what's expected in the next 100 years can't tell the difference anymore. So they actually are attracted to the smell of a predator if you give them a predator smell versus nothing. But if you give them a predator smell versus a non-predator smell, they spend equal time in either of the cues. And that's just because they can't distinguish between them. They can tell there's a smell, but they can't tell what it is.
Can't tell what it is.
Yeah.
Wow. So that is a definite result of the kind of climate change things that we're seeing and the additional human stuff that's being dumped into the oceans.
Yeah, it's definitely a result of the extra CO2 that's being put into the atmosphere. And because the world kind of all works in an equilibrium, all the CO2 we put in the atmosphere from, you know, cars and concrete, things like that, it equilibrates and back into the ocean. So the ocean actually absorbs about a fourth of the CO2 that we put in the atmosphere. And because it's pulling carbon dioxide into the water, it has this, you know, series of chemical steps that results in extra acid in the ocean, and that extra acid is what causes the behavioral impairments in fish.
Now, see, lay people like me and intern Abby, I mean, we're English majors, and you know, we hear ocean acidification, we think, oh, it must be killing fish directly if it gets too acid. But you're talking about a fascinating sort of chain reaction.
Yeah, so fish are actually really, really good at living in really acidic conditions, and for a long time, people just thought that they'd be fine because they don't actually die in very acidic conditions. What happens instead is because they breathe through their gills, so oxygen can pass through, and that's how they get oxygen in their body, the acid actually passes into them as well, just through diffusion. And to deal with that, they upregulate the amount of bicarbonate in their body just to make sure they're not too acidic. And all that bicarbonate actually affects a receptor in their brain called the GABA receptor. And then it's that GABA receptor that's important for making these behavior decisions. So when we first found the effect of ocean acidification on the sense of smell, our first thought was, oh, maybe it's burning their nose or their receptors in their nose is getting affected. But as we looked into it more, we found an effect on their hearing. We found an effect on their ability to learn. We found an effect on their vision. And because all of that more has to do with cognition rather than just their nose being burnt by too acidic conditions, we started to look into some brain things. So that's when we found out that the GABA receptor was the kind of reason why all this is happening. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. Like, their ability to live in acidic water is what's causing the problem that's making them not be smart enough to figure out different things, I guess.
That's really fascinating. So it's their body adapts to the acid, but the adaptation their body makes affects their brain.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Now, you're just back from receiving an award from James Cook University. What, you flew all the way to Cairns? How do you say the name of the town? Is it Cairns?
Cairns.
Cairns.
But I actually flew to Townsville, which is where the school is based. Cairns is a little more touristy and a little more fun than Townsville, but I was in Townsville. Yeah, so they flew myself and my wife to receive the award, which was really nice of them. It was the Early Career Alumni Award, so each school at the university got to give a alumni award and then an early career alumni award. You had to be under 35 to get the early career. So that's the award I received there.
As you're posting here at the University of Delaware, this is your second, your post-graduation, I should say, assignment at Georgia. You came here from Georgia Tech.
Yeah. So I actually was at Georgia Tech as a postdoc under Mark Hay. And then I started as a faculty member there, and I worked there for 2 years, and then now I'm here.
So, okay, so this is your second faculty appointment.
Second faculty appointment, cool. But third kind of since my PhD job.
Cool. Now, you're not teaching this semester because you're busily out there doing lots of different science.
Yeah, I'm busy trying to get my lab set up and get my students organized and try and get some extra research done and enjoy the time kind of not being trapped in a classroom. So
Watch it. I mean, we are part of a teaching university.
I love teaching. Don't get me wrong. But it's nice that I get some time to just set up and then get my lab in order and get some of the travel done. A lot of the trips I do are just really far away, so it's hard to do them on quick trips. Instead, you need to take a couple weeks at each location. So
I think the people listening would love to hear about some of the places you've dived. I mean, when we met with you last week, there's just like this litany of things that you've done where you're going off diving and looking.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten to dive in some pretty cool places. So during my my undergrad, I obviously dove in Hawaii and then Florida, the Florida Keys. I did an internship in South Africa with great white sharks, looking at the breaching behavior. So if you've ever seen the documentary Air Jaws, where they breach out of the water, I worked with that person for a while.
Time out. Great whites do the jump out of the water?
Yeah, in only certain places. South Africa has quite a bit of it happening. So you can tow like a seal decoy. It just looks like a shadow of a seal, I guess. You tow it underwater and they'll come up and try and attack it and they'll breach out of the water. It's really, really cool.
So it's one of their attack strategies.
Yeah, and it seems to be more linked to the bottom of the water so that they can propel themselves up because they can get that trajectory. I mean, they weigh, 2,000 pounds, so it's not easy to get them out of the water, but it was really cool to see it.
Wow.
Yeah, so I got to go cage diving with great whites like every day for a couple months when I was there.
That's not exactly on my bucket list.
Oh, it was on mine. it was one of the top things on mine.
But I think some of the things you did in Fiji and in places like that, that sounded really fascinating too.
Yeah, so during my PhD, I worked at Lizard Island, like I said before, and then I also did a lot of work in Papua New Guinea. There I got to go on a lot of live aboard boat trips and have a ton of kind of crazy experiences there. So we went to some islands that, they didn't even really use money. They kept coming up to the boat. The Papua New Guineans would come up to the boat and give us these beautiful conch shells or things that they found. And we'd say, oh, how much do you want? How many kina? And they wouldn't want kina. They wanted like 3 pieces of paper and a pencil or something strange. So
a barter economy.
Yeah. So you just give them that because they were on an island. It's called the Weetus. So it's a old volcanic island that is pretty far away from everything. So I don't even think they had much use for money there. So that was kind of cool. And then the coral there is just phenomenal, the coverage and the fish that you can see and all the animals you can see. So that's probably my favorite place to go diving is Papua New Guinea. And then I did my postdoc at Georgia Tech, but I was based in Fiji for most of that time. So out of my 24 months as a postdoc, I think 20 of them I spent in a village in Fiji. So I actually lived in the village and did all my research there. I got a lot done, but you definitely, I think when people picture living in Fiji, they picture living at a resort in Fiji, not living in sort of a modified garden shed in a Fijian village. Beautiful views and stuff, but you had to deal with all like the local politics and things like that.
Now, when Abby and I met with you a couple of weeks ago, you were talking about on that trip to Fiji, and I guess on some of the other trips you've gone to dive on reefs, part of it is you got to time it just right if you want to watch the coral bloom or the coral spawn.
Yeah, so coral actually only spawn one day a year, and the different species of corals, well, it's kind of down to not only do they spawn one day a year, they spawn at night, and certain species spawn, 5 hours after the sunset. Some spawn 6 hours after the sunset. So you can time it and go out on night dives, and then you can go there and collect the spawn if you want to do coral research, which I do every once in a while, or you can just kind of watch it happen. It's a pretty amazing thing to watch happen with the entire reef, all the corals letting their egg and sperm bundles out, and kind of looks like it's snowing on the reef, but these pink little bundles everywhere that float up. And yeah, so the research I do now is primarily conducted in Belize, and that's where I've been twice this summer for the coral spawning there. And you can put these kind of tents over the coral, and it funnels all the eggs into a little container, and then you can bring it into the lab and fertilize them yourself and then do work on the coral larvae. So I look at what kind of smells corals like and don't like.
The corals also are attracted to smells?
Yeah. So, these things are kind of little balls of snot, if anything. They're just these little tiny balls with, cilia around them that helps them swim around. And those cilia helps them to pick up chemical cues, but they're not like a fish with a face and a nose like you would think. So it was kind of surprising. It wasn't surprising that they can tell chemical cues. It was a little more surprising how good they are at reacting to them. But yeah, so the two trips I've done in Belize and then one of the coral spawn trips I did in Fiji were all looking at corals' chemical sensing abilities.
So you say chemical sensing abilities. Is it a sense of smell like for coral like we would have, or is it a different kind of just way of sensing chemical?
Yeah, because they don't really have an olfactory system like a nose, it's not probably appropriate to say smell really to a scientist. To layman's people, it's just easier to say coral smell. But yeah, they draw in chemical cues in a totally different way than a fish would or than we would. So it's more accurate to say chemical cues. But essentially, it's they're picking up smell, which we pick up chemical cues by smelling it.
Right.
They just pick it up in a different way.
What kinds of things do coral sense as good, what we would think of smells?
So corals and fish pretty much like the same things, which is pretty cool. They both really like reefs with high coral versus a lot of algae. So a quality reef versus kind of a degraded habitat. They like reefs that have a lot of different corals rather than just one type of coral. They like reefs that have themselves there versus reefs that have other species. That kind of makes sense evolutionarily, because if you're a coral, you basically are floating in the open ocean for a couple of days, and then you have to find a place to cement yourself to the ground. And you'd want to make sure you find a good reef. And if a reef smells like your species, obviously your parents have lived there and done well, so it's a good place for you to go. They like the smell of specific corals more than others, so they're able to kind of figure out which corals are more threat sensitive, so like a canary in a coal mine situation. And they like the smell of those threat sensitive corals, because if the reef has not had any threats, it'll smell like that. If the reef's been degraded, those corals won't be there. So they're able to pick up on that. They don't like the smell of a lot of algae, things like that. So
that's really interesting, because to me, being a layperson, I think of coral, this big block of, you know, as if it's one species. But you're making these reefs sound like they're really diverse in terms of just even the different kinds of coral that are, see nothing of the plants and the fish.
Corals are really complex. Coral reef systems are super complex. So they're pretty much like a rainforest underwater with how diverse it is. And yeah, there's corals, but there's a lot of different species of corals within that. And yeah, it can get really, really complex when you go into all the different formations and branching and species. But a lot of people, when you talk about corals, they're just like, oh, those rocks underwater, the pretty rocks. And
they're not rocks.
No, they're a plant and an animal. So they're even more unique. They have algae within them that helps them that they get food from, just like plants do. And then they also are an animal. So they have tentacles. They kind of look like little mini anemones under a microscope, and they can catch food and eat it that way too.
Didn't you have a conversation with some of the Fijians? They didn't realize that these rocks were alive?
Yeah, so when I started working in Fiji, I was talking to some of the Fijians, because you're not allowed to work on Sundays there because they're very religious, so we're not supposed to be in the water. But I had to be in the water on Sunday because that happened to be the day the corals were spawning, so I asked the village chief if it was okay for me to go out, and he gave me permission. But when I was explaining what I was doing, I said, oh, the corals are going to spawn, they're going to have babies, and I need to go out there and collect them, and it's the only day I can. And he's like, wait, those rocks have babies? I said, okay. So I made them a little video, and I gave it to them on a DVD, and I told them, you know, once I collected the eggs and sperm and they were fertilized, they could come over and look at them under the microscope. And I had a good chunk of the village show up to see the baby rocks, which they kept saying. I'm like, no, they're not rocks. They're a plant and an animal. But it was pretty cool to see them, just like an aha moment for most of them. Like, wait a minute.
We're talking with Danielle Dixon, a new faculty member in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. And as you're hearing her talk, I think one of the reasons that we recruited you to the University of Delaware is this kind of outreach you do for the community. I mean, because there you were interacting with the local Fiji village.
Yeah, I think community involvement and community interaction is really important in research, not only because kind of the point of research is that you're helping, at least for mine, is that I'm trying to do a lot of conservation research, and I really want the information to not just stop at scientists. I want it to go farther in the community and go to people that can make a difference. So when I was in Fiji and in Papua New Guinea a lot, the locals are the ones you're interacting with the most, and they can kind of make or break a study. So in Fiji, I had a number of plots that I would set out, and I'd hammer these nails in with flagging tape to mark where they were, and I'd come back 2 days later and someone would hand me a bag of nails with flagging tape on them and say, look, I found this. And those were all my plots. So then they got removed. And I quickly figured out that I needed to talk to them and get them on board. So I started making videos for the adults. And I found that when I recorded myself and included pictures and videos I took underwater, I speak slower when I'm recording myself, and then they could stop and reread it or rehear it. And then for the kids, I started making these little children's books that kind of explained one of my research projects in an age for like Very Hungry Caterpillar or like Rainbow Fish type of a book. And then that helped them to understand what I was doing. And not only was I telling them what I was doing, but why it was important and how it would affect them, so that they kind of figured out the cause and effect. I wasn't just out there for no reason, and the information I gained could actually benefit them in the long run. So it ended up working out really well.
They still live by fishing off the reefs?
Yeah, the Fijians use fishing quite heavily, so that's one of the reasons why their reefs are pretty degraded, as they like to eat. It's called the sivi sivi there, but it's the unicorn fish for us. It's this type of a tang that has a horn, so it really does look like a unicorn. But they eat this algae that tends to overgrow coral, and the problem is they also go to sleep at night, so it's really easy to catch them. You can just go underwater and spear them when they're sleeping, and the Fijians eat that quite a bit, so...
What about, have the lionfish invaded there?
So lionfish are actually endemic to that area. So there are lionfish there, but they're not out of control. The lionfish that are in the Caribbean are an invasive species from the Indo-Pacific, and they're out of control there. So we've done...
I get it. So that part of the Pacific is the lionfish native range.
Yeah, that's where they're actually from.
And it's the rest of the world where they are a problem.
Yeah. You know, they're from the whole Indo-Pacific area. They're a pretty broad range species, but... they're not at all from the Caribbean, so they shouldn't be anywhere in the Caribbean, Florida. I think they've been found as far north as New York, actually. I know there's been two in Delaware. I don't think they can survive the winter, but they tend to come up. They're really hardy fish and kind of the perfect invasive species, just because they're venomous, they're really hardy, they can reproduce often. I think every 4 days they can have more babies. And nothing really eats them here. So they have these crazy spines and look really scary and really hurt when you get stung. I found that out firsthand. So,
but in spite of all of that, they make good eating for humans if you know how to handle them, right?
Yeah, they're delicious. It's just a nice white flaky fish. So when we're in Belize waiting for the corals to spawn, because they are fairly predictable, but not always predictable. I think my trip last year, the corals were 9 days late of what we had thought. So in those time of when we were waiting, we were just out spearing lionfish and hunting them. And they're really good. So we ate lionfish a lot, and they're really good. There's just not a lot of meat to them. And to fish for them, you actually have to spear. So it's not like hooking line fishing. So it's harder to get them.
Now, we're recording this interview in September of 2015, which is going to mean we're talking to you before your first ever Coast Day.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it, though.
Every year, the first Sunday in October, at the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, on their Lewis, Delaware campus, there's a big event. It's one of the best events the university puts on. What are you going to be doing at it this year?
So for Coast Day this year, I'm giving a talk. I think my talk is at 12:30, and it's on ocean acidification and how it's affected everything from Nemo to sharks. And my lab is also going to be open for people to come through. My postdoc and my grad student are giving a poster, and I'll be around for all the fun festivities.
So you're going to be there on Sunday, October 4th, talking with people about chemical crypto smells in the ocean and ocean acidification. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time. We even have a lionfish that people can come and see, a live one in a tank.
Not prepped over a bed of rice.
Yep, not food to sample. A live lionfish.
Well, I want to ask you one thing that we had not talked about, maybe because I know you do a lot of work in reefs and the environment where all these different fish live. Up here in the Mid-Atlantic region and further north, we tend to dump old subway cars and train cars out in the ocean to make new reef habitats or make new habitats for fish. Is that effective?
I'm not the biggest fan of dumping stuff out in the ocean that we just have no use for. I know it's pretty popular to do that, but It definitely does make a habitat. Like, you'll quickly see things colonize it and live inside. But I just don't really think the ocean is the place for us to be putting basically garbage, which is essentially what it is.
Well, that's basically, you're right. I mean, it seems to me we're dumping our refuse out there and making ourselves feel better about it because, well, we've been overfishing, so we'll build a habitat so fish have a place to live.
Yeah, I think it's kind of just to help our conscience. But it does provide some kind of habitat. I think if we stopped destroying their habitat, then we would not have to create artificial habitat. And I just, there's a lot of consequences. There's a lot of stuff in things like subway cars and ships and things that are just not supposed to be underwater. So, or not in a traditional reef habitat or in, you know, benthic environment. So you're adding a lot more than just structure. It'd be different if we were making structure out of reef rocks or something, but subway cars have a lot more to them than just, you know, external
shape.
Places for things to hide in. So
I can just imagine just even the pigments and some of the other chemicals that are in the seats and things like that might pose some issues.
Yeah, and break down. And I mean, there's been oil on the wheels and grease and things like that. So I don't think it's a good idea. I think
what are some more effective things to try? Or this far north, I mean, the things we can do to build up the reefs in the areas where you study, can any of that work be moved up into the Mid-Atlantic region?
Yeah, so one of the kind of focus of the next step of my research is after I identify what chemical cues are important or what smells are really important to make a reef good or to make a reef seem bad to the animals, I want to start trying to outplant these cues. So take fragments of corals and put them out and see if that increases recruitment to an area. Because if you can increase recruitment, especially to the important fish that eat the algae on a reef that's starting to degrade, maybe you can kind of flip the tables and it'll start to be healthy. One of the things I want to do and take advantage of the Delaware summer is start to kind of apply those same concepts to this area. So start to look at what makes a salt marsh or, you know, the coastal environments here a healthy one versus a degraded one. And then see if we can also do the same kind of outplanting of different smells or cues to see if we can help that get better. Coastal development tends to be a really big problem here. I have a lot of research showing that the terrestrial cues, so the tree leaves and things, are really important for coral reef fish to find the reef. So if you think about it, reefs are hard, fast, stuck on the ground. And the cues that they have can export, but only a certain distance away, dependent on currents and tides and things. But leaves actually drop from terrestrial sources and go into the water, and they can go much farther. So coral reef fish that are associated with islands actually use the native plants to find the island homes, and they don't use non-native plants. So I do have a lot of research showing that what we're doing on the shoreline actually does impact the water in ways that, you know, we wouldn't have thought of. So not just preventing runoff or whatever. Native plants are really important too. And for coral reef wise, a lot of people like to vacation where it's pretty and tropical and things like that. So a lot of the native plants on a reef are being taken away for resorts or farming or things like that. Or they're being replaced with, you know, like coconut farms or mahogany or sugarcane or things of that nature. And the same may be true for the local animals here that rely on some of those salt marsh plants or the coastal native plants that are being replaced by other things that we find more pretty or practical or just our beach houses. So some of that work I'm going to try and start doing here just to understand the local systems here a little bit better and apply what I know from the tropical environment to the temperate waters.
If you want to meet our guest, Danielle Dixon, go to Coast Day on Sunday, October 4th. Down at the Lewis campus of the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. And you'll hear more about her research with the reefs. I think that's really fascinating, trying to apply it to some of the salt marshes up here.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good time. I'm excited to be at Delaware for sure.
Thank you, Danielle.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD, or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at wvud.org.